Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, if they had wanted to, lawmakers could have snuck almost anything into that spending bill they're voting on. Who knows? Maybe they did. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 10th of December today. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. True to form, the Congress of the United States has taken it down to the wire. The it in question here is the continued operation of the federal government. Last night, the House released a $1.1 trillion spending bill that will keep most parts of the federal bureaucracy funded through the end of next September. It runs 1,603 pages, is not, as you might imagine, light reading, but some important things are buried deep in the legislative language. For instance,
page 1,599, separate contribution.
In the money and politics category, the maximum donation a person can make to a political party increases dramatically from $32,000 or so to more than $320,000.
Page 615.
In the money and banking category, the bill waters down Dodd-Frank a bit. It puts the government potentially on the hook if certain derivative trades go bad.
Page 809, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
There are about 10 million Americans in what are called multi-employer pensions when businesses in the same industry join with unions to offer pension coverage. Think construction and supermarkets in particular. The bill lets those benefits be cut if the pension funds get into trouble.
Page 213. None of the funds.
There were, all of that said, some surprises in this thing as well. Washington, D.C. was reminded that it is still basically run by Congress. The Cromnibus, as it's called, will block last month's voter-approved initiative in the district to legalize marijuana. And finally,
page 640. None of the funds made available.
There are a lot of fancy portraits in all those government offices in Washington, D.C., executive branch employees, lawmakers, and agency officials. They can run $20,000 or more, those portraits can. But if this thing passes, you are not going to have to pay for them. If high-ranking officials, including the president, by the way, want somebody to paint a huge picture of them to hang up in public, that's all fine. They just got to pay for it themselves. All right, moving on from that minutia, Uber continues to be unable to get out of its own way. The latest development is that the ride-sharing company is being sued by district attorneys in Los Angeles and San Francisco and some other cities over how well it protects its customers and how well it complies with local law and regulations. Add to that the company's history of doing unsavory things with all the data that it has, tracking one-night stands, just to pick an example, and it is not a pretty public relations picture. So, assuming it wanted to, how might Uber clean up its reputation? Sally Herships has that story.
Uber was tracking its customers to see how many were doing the walk of shame, but now it's the company that looks like a hot mess.
When you think about brands, really, people judge them the exact same way that you judge people.
Allison Schoenholtz is with Siegel & Gale, a global branding firm. She says Uber could start cleaning up its reputation by admitting its mistakes, but what it really needs to do is change its practices so the same problems don't happen again.
To just apologize alone isn't going to be enough for Uber.
What is obvious about Uber is they don't have a crisis management strategy in place. At all.
Brad Hecht is chief research officer at Reputation Institute. He says in some ways, Uber is like a little kid at the adult's table, but no one's told it which fork to use or trained the company's executives about how to deal with the media or with a crisis.
You have to respond immediately. You have to be transparent. You have to apologize and be accountable. And you have to have a plan about how you're looking to resolve it.
Hecht says it's not about the problem. It's about how a company reacts. Peter Himmler is founder of PR firm Flatiron Communications. He says Uber needs help, but luckily for the company, its backers recently came out in support.
Ashton Kutcher, who's an investor, and Jason Calacanis, both of whom have huge followings on social media, actually weighed in Uber's support.
Uber says its growth has come with some growing pains, and acknowledging its mistakes are the first steps towards fixing them. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The trading logic on Wall Street today went a little something like this. Those falling oil prices aren't falling because of excess supply anymore. It's because demand is down. Lower demand indicates slowing economic activity, hence a big sell-off in New York. It will be the sad music when we get there. Vladimir Putin is making a quick trip to India today and tomorrow. It's the Russian president's first trip since Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power back in May. The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar is in Delhi. Sanjoy, good to have you with us.
Hello.
This visit comes at an interesting time, what with Ukraine and Western sanctions and geopolitics and geoeconomics of all kind. What is President Putin trying to get done with this visit, do you think?
Well, as you say, it's come at a very interesting time. Ahead of the visit, in fact, President Putin suggested that he now needs to look at Asia to increase trade. India is a very old trusted partner, an old Cold War ally. And even if things haven't been quite as good between the two countries as they have in the past, he still believes this is a country that he can hope to rely on. India didn't back the Western sanctions and therefore is seen very much as a trusted Russian ally.
It's worth a mention here that Russian-Indian trade is only something like $10 billion, like 10% of what it is, what Russian trade is with China. I mean, so there's room to grow, I suppose you could say.
There's a lot of room to grow, but at the same time, it's indicative of the fact that, you know, the two countries have never really matched their potential. India's got to the stage where they believe that they can now diversify their trade baskets. The relationship with the United States, for instance, has grown massively over the past decade. So both countries actually have come out of the Cold War with a slightly different outlook, and that's one reason why trade between them has sort of remained stagnant.
Who do you suppose needs whom more? Does President Putin need India, or does India need the Russians?
At the moment, the belief here in India is that President Putin needs India a little more, quite simply because India offers Russia a massive market. There are a few deals which we believe the two sides may agree on. One is to continue supplying nuclear energy, but there's also supplying India's massive needs for oil and gas. But from India's point of view, Russia is just another in a long list of countries it's beginning to do business with. And so it believes that it does have that advantage of having plenty to pick from.
Is this visit in the headlines at all, or are the locals just kind of, he's here, so what?
It is a bit in the headlines because there's an emotional connect with Russia. Many Indians growing up look at Russia as an ally that, you know, has always stood by India in times of need. But I have to say, the excitement in India is actually to another visit we are expecting towards the end of January. And that's when President Obama comes visiting, which gives you a sense very much of the way India looks at the world these days. President Obama makes headlines. President Putin has come here many times. But yes, what he does will be something that a lot of people look at it with interest.
And you have to imagine that anticipation over President Obama is making President Putin a little bit crazy. Sanjoy Majumdar, he is the BBC's India correspondent. We got him in Delhi. Sanjoy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Secretary of State John Kerry is going to be in Lima, Peru tomorrow, jumping in near the end of a two-week conference on climate change. The meeting is mostly a setup for negotiations to get a global agreement at another conference in Paris next fall. One of the big themes at this one, though, has been what you might call make me an offer. Countries making individual pledges to do something about global warming instead of everybody trying to agree on a big multinational treaty. The interesting part is who is stepping up and why. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
The big break happened a month ago. Before these talks, China joined the U.S. in promising to reduce emissions long-term. Ray Kopp is with Resources for the Future.
The way the paradigm has always been laid out for the past 20 years, developing countries, China included, really don't have to take on actions, okay, or make commitments. Only the developed world needs to do that.
The idea was poor countries need fossil fuels to build their economies. Rich countries, having already done so, would pay to solve the problems those fuels create. But China is now the world's number one emitter, and its increasingly prosperous citizens are choking on smog. Other developing countries have their own reasons for coming forward. Elliot Duringer is with the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions.
Clearly, the recognition that climate change is not some future concern, but in fact a here and now threat, is driving a lot of countries to pay closer attention and to say yes.
The Philippines, both a developing nation and a nation of islands, had actively resisted the idea of requirements for poor countries. Not anymore. Weather disasters have cost the country 5% of GDP every year since 2008, according to a Philippine official. Now the country says it will cut emissions and urge all nations to do the same. Robert Stavins directs the Harvard Project on Climate Agreements. He says other countries that haven't yet pledged a national contribution to reducing global emissions will probably come forward soon. Mexico, South Africa, South Korea have all started creating their own domestic climate policies.
That's precisely what is required for them to make a national contribution. That's what this whole structure is about.
That is, everyone antes up. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's actually a very strategic move in terms of how our radio stations are rated.
Don't touch that dial. Christmas music straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. There you go. You knew they were coming, right? Come on. The Dow Industrials tumbled 268 points today, 1.5%. Hence, the Wawa trombones closed at 17,533. The NASDAQ off 82 points, nearly 1.75%, finished at 4684. The S&P 500 gave back 33 points, 1.6%, ended things at 2,026. Every sector was hit today, but there was, of course, a big sell-off in energy shares after global oil prices touched a five-year low. Some of the big losers out there, 77 Energy down 16%, Goodrich Petroleum down 8% today. But when energy stocks go down, you know what goes up? Airline shares go up, that's what. An analyst at Barclays predicted billions of dollars in savings for airlines on fuel costs next year. Hence, United Continental Holdings and Southwest up 1.8% today. Bonds rose because all that money had to go someplace. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.16%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace has been on the air for 25 years. And believe me when I tell you that could not have happened without support from listeners like you. So please, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today and help us keep our coverage relevant and compelling. And you should know that your gift in any amount counts twice. That's thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st and help us reach our goal of at least 2,500 donors. And thank you so much for your support. Also, this is Kai Rosdahl, in case you didn't know who this was.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Did consumers jump on Black Friday deals? The Commerce Department issues retail sales for November. The United Nations marks International Mountain Day with the theme Mountain Farming. And it featured a lot of crime in Hawaii and Tom Selleck. The television series Magnum P.I. debuted on December 11, 1980. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Healthcare spending in this country last year came to almost $3 trillion. Best guesses are that as much as a third of that, a cool trillion or so, was wasted. Excessive testing, unnecessary procedures, those are probably the things you're thinking of. But you know, sometimes waste is just waste, as in the stuff that gets thrown away. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Every few months, typically Friday nights around 6, Nurse Dean Kirshner throws what she calls a drug party, except she says there's nothing fun about it.
If the public knew how we had to destroy so many drugs, I think they would be surprised.
Just like in nursing homes around the country, Kirshner has all these drugs on hand because a patient may go home before finishing a prescription, has an allergic reaction 3 days into a 30-day supply, or just passes away. And people in nursing homes are typically on lots of meds, which explains all this popping. Kirshner takes 2, sometimes 3 hours to push pills out of blister packs, white sheets of drugs, individually packaged, safe in cellophane.
This is Leviquin and Lofebra. Leviquin is an antibiotic. I don't know what Lofebra is. These would totally be reusable. They don't expire until 2015.
By federal law, nursing homes like this one in San Jose, California, are forbidden from dispensing pills to other patients, even if it's the same prescription. So they get destroyed, these perfectly safe, up-to-date medications, which are already paid for, often by federal or state governments, and are being cooked into healthcare concoctions in more than 16,000 nursing homes and other long-term care facilities around the country.
It's a multicolored bag full of pills and capsules that smells kind of minty, minty and fruit flavored. You can see the liquid in there sloshing around, and I will box this up along with everything else and ship it off.
Data on this stuff is hard to come by. University of Chicago researchers put together an estimate for Marketplace. As much as $2 billion a year of drugs that go into these long-term care facilities is being wasted. Reusable meds are being thrown out, while one in four struggle to afford their prescriptions. That makes no sense to George Wong of the California-based nonprofit Serum, which wants to reduce prescription waste.
I think lots of people can understand why there is such a desire to find an appropriate outlet to be able to take that medicine and get it out of the waste stream and into someone's hands.
Serum says $700 million worth of medications can be salvaged each year. That's 10 million prescriptions. The nonprofit is hoping to replace with... Instead of brewing some medicinal stew, Nurse Dean Kirshner is scanning drugs for donation with software developed by Serum. The group hopes to make it easy and cheap for nursing homes to ship unused drugs to pharmacies that will dispense it to low-income and uninsured folks. Serum's not alone in this line of work.
It's just such a simple concept, and it has really, really helped real people.
For the last decade, Linda Johnson's convinced retired docs to travel the northeast corner of Oklahoma, picking up unused meds, redistributing $16 million worth so far. Federal statistics show the most common class of drugs found in long-term care facilities are for behavioral health. Johnston knows psych drugs can be the difference between staying in work and being laid off, being healthy at home or admitted to the ER, out on your own, or incarcerated.
The shameful thing is to waste it. The shameful thing is to flush it down the toilet.
She means that literally. But even if you do get drugs to people in need, it doesn't solve the simple problem that taxpayers continue buying drugs that don't need to be bought. This corner of healthcare is so upside down, pharmacists face a dilemma: maximize revenue and waste perfectly good drugs, or invest in better technology and lose money. University of Chicago economist Rena Conti says this is an old story in healthcare. With twisted financial incentives, often come snarls of waste.
If we want to solve this problem for real, there needs to be some clear and concise guidance across federal and state policy on how to deal with these issues.
The thing is, nobody knows whether money saved on less waste would even offset additional costs that may come. As far as Linda Johnson's concerned, what we do know is that drug donation matters. She keeps thinking about a young man who got antidepressant medication.
He wanted me to know that he was not going to commit suicide because he had the medication, he could take it.
Today, he's enrolled in school. He's working towards his dream, Johnson says, earning a college degree. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Back in 2003, the National Football League changed the way head coaching positions and some other senior jobs were filled. Teams would have to interview minority candidates for those jobs, although they wouldn't, we should say, be obliged to hire them. It's called the Rooney Rule. And now Bob Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television, has a similar suggestion for the American business community. Mr. Johnson, it's good to have you with us.
Kai, good to be here. Thank you.
You have been pushing for this, let's call it the Fortune 500 version of the Rooney Rule, for a while now. What kind of traction are you getting, sir?
Well, I've been getting very good traction on the what I've come to call the RLJ rule, which, as you said, is a version of the Rooney Rule.
You got to brand it. I get that. Good job.
You got to brand it. But it simply says enhance best practices, increase the pool of applicants, and then give everyone a chance to be considered. And if the minority meets the qualifications, they should be given every opportunity to be hired.
When you talk to your peers, what do they say, both the minorities and the non-minorities? What do they say?
The reaction I've gotten from CEOs and people, companies where I serve on the board, is that this is something many of them say that they already do. The Lowe's Corporation, the home improvement company, does that emphatically. And other companies do it as well. The difference, I think, is that the companies say they do it. They have a commitment to do it. But unfortunately, the results don't show up in terms of the numbers yet.
Right. There's a little put up or shut up here, right? Because, and not to cast aspersions on the NFL, because lots of people do that about lots of other things. But, you know, people get interviewed, Rooney Rule applicants get interviewed, and then some white guy gets hired. How worried are you about the lip service aspect of the RLJ rule?
Well, yeah, obviously, on a voluntary program like the RLJ rule, it takes a commitment from the top, and the top being the CEO, of course, and then, of course, the members of the board of directors. And I'm not saying this is any way overt race discrimination. It's principally mainly a system of where people tend to hire people they know first. And if they're satisfied with who they hired first, they don't look any further. You get more African-Americans in that deal flow, I guarantee you, you create more people who are successful, as I've been fortunate to be in this country, because there are a lot of talented minority Americans out there who work hard, have great college degrees and background and education, but they just don't have that open door opportunity to show what they can do.
What is success going to look like for you?
Well, success would look like to me if the percentage of minorities who are in the workforce would be equal to that of percentage of white Americans who are in the workforce. What we're asking for is a fair chance and a fair shot. If you would give minority Americans of all stripes that fair shot, I can't imagine why this would not be in the long-term best interest of the United States, both in terms of global competitiveness and in terms of a stronger economy in the United States.
Bob Johnson, you know him best possibly as the guy who founded Black Entertainment Television. He also used to own the Charlotte Bobcats of the NBA. He is also the creator of the RLJ rule that we've been talking about. Mr. Johnson, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Kai, thank you for listening, and thank you for your listeners.
Had you happened to be in Louisville, Kentucky in late October this year, the day before Halloween to be precise, you might have heard this on the radio in your rental car.
Louisville's original Christmas music station.
Light 106.9.
Yeah, that was Christmas music. 106.9 went all Christmas all the time in October, one of seven stations that made the switch that month. By the week before Thanksgiving, more than 100 other stations had joined them. And Nova Sappho reports that Christmas music is coming to your radio earlier and earlier every year.
Ugh, if you're like me and you groan as soon as you hear those jingles, it may be little comfort to find out why stations are engaged in a Christmas music arms race.
It's actually a very strategic move in terms of how our radio stations are rated.
That's Shane Collins. He runs WVEZ in Louisville, the Light 106.9 station. And he's the guy to blame for switching to Christmas music while people are still trick-or-treating.
We gain a tremendous amount of total audience. You know, there are occasions where the audience will increase as much as 40 and 50%.
So if Collins is playing Christmas music in October instead of December, he gets two extra months of huge audiences. The increase in what's called the rating share means more advertising dollars.
On average in the city of Louisville, a one share increase averages out to about a $400,000 gain.
Little wonder, then, that stations across the country are elbowing each other to be known as the Christmas music station in their cities. John Miller has been watching the phenomenon from his perch at Nielsen Audio. They're the rating system for radio stations.
There's not room for four or five stations to do it in every market and get really big ratings. Whoever owns the position tends to benefit the most.
Miller says that's why stations switch earlier and earlier each year as they try to become the Christmas music leader. By the end of the year, some 500 stations will make the switch. Industry consultant Jim Richards says the phenomenon picked up steam only in the last 10 years or so. And at first, stations were cautious.
We started doing it over Thanksgiving holiday. Certainly the start of the Christmas shopping season happens there. And we weren't interrupting our normal listening habits.
Richard says early on, the fear was that unhappy listeners, Grinches like me, might abandon radio stations forever. But that's not what's happened.
The phenomenon of this whole thing is that, for the most part, come the second week of January or the third week of January, the listeners patterns of radio usage pretty much return to normal.
As if nothing had happened. Which means stations don't suffer any long-term damage with their core audience. So the lucrative Christmas music format turns out to be the radio world's version of a self-bought gift. I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which covers both brand imaging and automotive engineering, all in 36 very compact little seconds. BMW has partnered with the website Medium for a sponsored series of posts that, and this is a quote, explain how BMW's design process works. Today's topic is the acoustics of high-end BMW cars, specifically how a door on the new BMW 4 Series Grand Coupe sounds when it closes. So, this being a radio show, here's the sound. This is what the prototype sounded like before the acoustic engineers got their hands on it. And here's the after. That was pretty quick, so we'll do it for you one more time. Here you go. And after. Oh, yeah. No, you hear that? Wasn't that great? Me neither. But it will cost you $46,725 if you want it. All right, we're done. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. They could probably hear it, huh? I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.